Today, I'm pleased to introduce to you Dr. Saria Sicoccio. Saria is the Ambulatory Chief Medical Officer for Prisma Health in Greenville, South Carolina. Saria is a family physician who, as you will hear, has a very interesting career driven by a variety of patient-centered interests. Saria completed her Master's in Healthcare Administration in 2012. Saria is also currently serving as a member of the Physician Advisory Group for DHG Healthcare. DHG Healthcare does a variety of consulting engagements throughout the country for healthcare organizations. The Physician Advisory Group has the expertise and knowledge to provide the company with feedback and insights regarding their consulting offerings to various healthcare organizations. Hello and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Bedside. I am your host, Dr. Norm Chapin. Beyond the Bedside is a podcast that will help you find a non-clinical role and take your career in new, rewarding, and sometimes unanticipated directions. I'm very happy that you are here to learn about opportunities beyond the bedside. Well, tonight on Beyond the Bedside, I'm happy to welcome my guest, Saria Sicoccio, to my show. Saria and I met several months ago when we were attending a conference, and I was fascinated by her journey to an administrative role, and I am very excited that you're joining us tonight, Saria. Thank you.
Thanks, Norm. I'm excited to participate.
I'm really looking forward to this. I've been looking forward to this for the past month and a half, and as you know, we had a few technical challenges and time schedule challenges getting this organized, but we're finally here, and it's great to hear your voice.
Finally connected.
So maybe you could start out by just, in general terms, telling my audience what it was that made you decide to pursue a career in medicine.
Well, Norm, I started truly at the bedside in solo practice in Fort Lauderdale. From residency, I thought it's important to me that patients are treated the way patients deserve to be treated. I thought the best way to do that was to start my own practice, hire my mother as my office manager, and we went to work seeing patients. No other staff, and had an incredible experience seeing patients in the office, in the hospital, and in their homes. And while I enjoyed that tremendously, what I especially appreciated during my experience in those years was teaching medical students and residents. And so from that point on, what I realized is there would be a greater opportunity to not only continue to see patients and maintain that patient-physician relationship, but also teach others to do the same and watch the light go on for others and see that passion grow for patient care. So I taught at a family medicine residency program in Rome, Georgia, for a couple of years, and truly enjoyed the opportunity to connect with learners. And it also lit a fire for me for public health and providing care to the entire community. So while it is a privilege to see patients in the office, I absolutely enjoy that in the hospital, in their homes, it's another when you can treat the entire community. So what do I mean by that? It's not only managing their diabetes and their high blood pressure, but also making sure that a community has resources for tobacco cessation, that we have parks in our area so that people can walk safely, focusing on entire lifestyle modifications by addressing the social determinants of health. Now, while about 10 years ago, when I started the journey outside of direct patient care, I didn't necessarily call it out as social determinants of health. What I have enjoyed is that opportunity specifically. So when you ask me what enticed me out of direct patient care, it would be being a family physician for all, for the entire community and the neighborhoods that we serve.
So when you started your practice, and I believe you said it was in Florida, it sounded like you almost had a throwback practice. We're very involved with home visits and nursing home care, those types of things.
Well, yes, exactly. And ironically, Norm, there was one day where the newspaper came out in the Miami paper, and on the front page was my practice, and it was returning to Marcus Welby. And it's for that reason, for having that close connection with patients by spending extra time with them to help support them in their lifestyle changes and creating a healthy life for them and their families. It truly was a return to Marcus Welby for me. And he is an inspiring hero that I look at when I consider that direct patient and physician relationship.
So what was it that, as you completed your residency, what was it that really inspired you to set up that type of practice? Was it some experience in your childhood? Was it an experience you had in your training career? What brought you to the decision to open that type of a practice?
Well, Norm, that's a good question, because not a lot of folks these days open their own practices directly out of residency. They may go somewhere else first. And while several of my mentors or attendings had suggested and wisely advised to go get some experience first, I was very passionate about how we treat patients. And unfortunately, in my residency experience, all too often, I saw that we forgot that the patient was at the center of the work that we did, that it truly was a privilege to serve these patients and walk them through some of the most fearful experiences of their lives. And so for that reason, I wanted to ensure that I could hire those that I knew put the patient first, and that we followed a practice that ensured that the patient was at the center of their care. And the best way to do that is to open your own practice and to start it off with that in mind and as a philosophy. And it drew that type of patient who appreciated and was attracted to that type of experience with their family physician.
Well, I think it's an unusual, it certainly is, as you said, it's an unusual practice model for many physicians today who seem to be looking for larger practice arrangements or with hospitals or even with large multi-specialty groups. What year did you start your practice? What year did you finish your residency and start your practice?
In 2004. So it has been quite a few years since then. It was the beginning of the electronic medical record era. So I started with an EMR. There may be some folks who are familiar with Dr. Gordon Moore, who's a family physician who designed and tagged the term micropractice, which means taking care of a smaller patient panel so that you can spend more time with the patients, reducing your overhead for your practice and your business so that it allows enough time to also serve those patients without losing your shirt.
So you sort of drew some inspiration from that micropractice type of model that he espoused?
Yes, I did. And it gave me an opportunity to learn a tremendous amount about medicine, the business of healthcare, taking care of patients, and working with insurance companies and employers to really understand what's paid for patients and what they struggle with personally to pay their bills.
So how did you become introduced to Dr. Moore? How did you learn about him or hear about him? Was he affiliated with your medical school or residency?
He wasn't. However, I was an avid reader and still am. And I remember the first article I read was in the Family Practice Management Journal. And routinely, he would submit articles talking about his practice and how he could make it work and the experiences of the patient. Mm-hmm. And it was just so appealing to think about embracing and taking that relationship with the patient and keeping it sacred in healthcare. And that's why I was drawn to be a Marcus Welby of the 21st century, if you will.
So how long did you maintain that practice? Was that, I know you mentioned you eventually transitioned into education and that you love that part of it. So tell me about the number of years that you were in just solo practice and then the transition into more of an educator role.
Yes. Well, of course, I intended to stay in solo practice forever. I thought that would be my story. And my husband and I planted roots in South Florida. I moved my mother down from Georgia to practice with me. And lo and behold, a couple of years into practice, we had our first child. And as many parents or listeners may be familiar with, your whole world changes literally overnight with the birth of that child. And it was at that moment in time that my husband and I decided that we wanted to be a part of a smaller community, a place where people knew your name and your children, that we had parks that we could play at and schools for our children to come. So at that point, we thought we wanted to move to a smaller community, if you will, from South Florida and Fort Lauderdale, where we still have family, to a smaller town such as Rome, Georgia, which is where we ended up. And that there were about 45,000 people who lived there. So big enough to take care of patients, that's for sure, but small enough that you have that small town feel. And that was something that was very important to me as a mother. So you asked how long that was. I started practice in 2004 and started working in Rome, Georgia in 2008. So just 4 years later. So time flies quickly. And I was grateful to be able to turn my practice over to another graduating resident who shared the same passion. So it was such a relief as I had my second child that I could then transition out of practice, but then hand over those patients safely to another physician right out of residency.
Well, it certainly is true that sometimes our life situations certainly play a dramatic role in our career paths. And it sounds like you experienced your first one with the beginning of your family, with you and your husband starting a family. So the practice that you, or the role that you had in Rome when you got there, were you again in a solo private practice, or was that when you actually became an employee of an organization that ran a family practice residency?
Yes, so the latter is correct. Okay. I was hired on as an associate program director at the Floyd Family Medicine Residency Program. And it was such an incredible experience to watch and learn from the interns and the residents from this program. I used to refer to them as the superheroes of the hospital. They saved lives. They delivered babies. They took care of patients from cradle to grave. And it was a privilege, truly, to teach them and watch them learn how to best take care of a community, regardless of what community is and what zip code they move to. But they truly learned the full scope of family medicine, which was enjoyable, and especially enjoyable for me to teach for those years that I was present in Rome.
So how was your work time split when you began the associate program director role? How much protected administrative time or teaching time did you have? And how much time did you have, if any, to see your own panel of patients?
Well, you mentioned earlier, as life cycles impact us, being a new mother now with two children, I balanced two full-time jobs, I guess you could say. I did have a small patient panel of my own, typically about a half a day a week. I'd get to see my very own patients and then had perhaps a day of administrative time. However, there was call at the hospital and patients in the office and preparing for presentations for educational symposiums. So it was a balance in those years. Meanwhile, I chose at that time to go back to school and sought my master's for healthcare administration at the same time. So there's only 24 hours in the day. That still stands as a truth. However, somehow I think I got done 36 hours worth of work every day.
Well, that's quite a bit to do with young children, just learning a new role as an associate program director, and then also taking on the added challenge of getting your master's in healthcare administration. Did you take that as a online courses, or did you have to travel for the MHA? Where did you get your MHA degree?
Yes. Yeah, so the answer would be both. I went to University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill for my Master's of Healthcare Administration, which was an incredible experience. It was their executive program. So several times a year, we would travel to Chapel Hill and connect and work on projects together, finish up one semester, start another, and dig in for almost 3 years in that program, living in Georgia and then following up with jumping over North Carolina and living in Virginia for a few years gave me an opportunity to stay close and connect also with other executives and professionals in healthcare, be it pharmacists or other physicians. There were attorneys. There were all types of individuals, including general administrators. And that enriched the experience of learning from one another what it's truly like to be an administrator in healthcare.
So it sounds like during this time you had another job transition. You mentioned you moved from Georgia to Virginia. Is that correct?
That's right. I did. And who would have thought? I didn't know this was in my plan, but it is a small world. A mentor of mine from several years ago, actually since medical school, talked with me. He suggested I try out interviewing as a chief medical officer at a local health system in Virginia. And I thought, well, why not? It'll be a good experience. I'll interview for an executive role. It was a direction I was considering for the future. just not that soon. And next thing I know, we're packing up the minivan and the moving truck and moving the entire family up to Virginia.
Now, what was the system that you took a job with in Virginia?
So I was the chief medical officer for Danville Regional Medical Center in Danville, Virginia, and then subsequently the southern market, which included Martinsville and Danville in Virginia for LifePoint Health Systems.
So LifePoint is a for-profit health system that is owned by Duke. Is that correct?
Well, they certainly have a partnership with Duke. They have their Duke LifePoint partnership, but LifePoint Health is its standalone for-profit health system, and they have multiple relationships with Duke, which actually originated with the hospital that I was the CMO at Danville Regional Medical Center. We had some partnerships to begin with, and then we recognized there was an opportunity to partner for quality and improve our highly reliable systems throughout our organization. And it was a tremendous experience to meet with experts and be inspired by those who research quality and patient safety and drive resilience for healthcare workers and to support patient care.
So now you're the CMO of a single hospital in Virginia, eventually expanding into a larger market with several hospitals, or at least two hospitals, it sounds like. And over what period of time did that evolution occur? How long were you in the role at Danville before you were given additional responsibilities?
Yes, we moved to Danville, Virginia in 2010. And 4 short years later, we were packing up once again, and I was recruited to Greenville, South Carolina, as the chief medical officer for Bon Secours St. Francis Health System.
So then you moved from Virginia to South Carolina, and you took in a sense, a lateral move. You were still the chief medical officer, but you were in a different healthcare system.
Yes, it was in fact a larger role in a larger health system locally.
Okay.
With a market of 2 hospitals, a wider range of delivery services, and more practices within our medical group.
Now,
and a great community to move to. And that was also a draw.
And your children, obviously, how old were your children when you moved to Greenville?
I have to think back because time goes by so fast.
It does, doesn't it?
It does. They were 9 and 7.
Okay.
Oh my goodness. 9 and 7.
You said a couple of things as you were talking about your work in Danville, which I'm very passionate about, and I know you are too from our previous conversations, but you talked about high reliability, you talked about quality, you talked about resilience. When did you become formally involved in these activities around patient safety and reducing harm to patients and staff that you and I both see as sort of our core values?
Well, Norm, as you know, when you're the CMO, you are ultimately responsible for the patient safety and quality of care that's delivered every day in every encounter for patients and families within a health system. For me, that was also my experience. Day one, we jumped right in with quality and patient safety concerns that came forward, though I was completely new to this role. And a family physician at heart, I quickly learned that the team around me would create success in a highly reliable system when we worked together and collaborated towards patient care and quality first.
During your MHA or at some point subsequent to that, did you get any formal training around high reliability science or lean, that type of thing?
It wasn't until my master's at UNC Chapel Hill that I was entrenched into that experience and the training. Certainly, we talked about quality of care when I taught and, of course, in my practice, but it hadn't necessarily been labeled that way, or nor was it a intentional training experience up until then.
So at what point in your career did you move into a role that was completely non-clinical, fully administrative?
Well, there was a brief period of time that I was completely administrative, and that was when I was recruited to Greenville as the CMO for Bon Secours St. Francis. And interestingly, I recall the interview process and the recruiters sharing with me that they were looking specifically for someone who was not doing any clinical work. And I thought that was curious because in most health systems that I've been exposed to, they encourage their leadership to participate in some form of clinical work. So that's not always the case. And it was honestly a struggle for me for that first year that I was present. They recommended that I don't talk much about the clinical side so that they were aligned with more of an administrative role. And, you know, it was an interesting moment. And I remember the exact day when I made up my mind to go back and do some clinical work. And we were visiting with one of our legislators in South Carolina at our hospital. And he leaned over. And after the end of the conversation, he said, "Dr. Sicosio, are you taking any new patients? Because I need a primary care doctor." And I looked to my CEO and I said, "Well, it's up to my CEO. I would love to start seeing patients, but at this time, that's not been part of the role." So mm-hmm. by adding that leverage of your local legislator to say that it is indeed an important role for a physician, even at the highest level of executive status at the health system. From that point on, I have been working at our Greenville Free Clinic for the last several years.
What percentage of time or how many hours a week would you devote to the free clinic?
Well, unfortunately, with my schedule, I've only been able to dedicate one half day per month to the free clinic. However, I do have my own patient panel that I see routinely every month. And now in my new role, or the role I've been in for the last about 2.5 years as the ambulatory chief medical officer and department chair of family medicine at Prisma Health and University of South Carolina, Greenville, I also teach residents and medical students once again. So half day a month, I get to participate in our Center for Family Medicine clinic and precept residents and medical students. So it's been fun coming full circle, if you will.
So it sounds like right now you have a balance of clinical and a small amount of clinical responsibilities, but certainly the majority of your work is administrative. You mentioned that you're now working with what is a relatively new system in South Carolina, Prisma Health. Tell my listeners a little bit about your current activities and your current role.
Yes, Norm. And to give a little bit of history, when I first came over to the health system, we were Greenville Health System, and we partnered with Palmetto from Columbia, South Carolina, back in the fall of 2017. So as we refer to ourselves as becoming Prisma Health, we have finally arrived. It's a great nonprofit health system where I serve as the department chair of family medicine. And we have a medical school, the University of South Carolina, Greenville. I help support our academics program and recruit for primary care. And I also serve and have the pleasure of supporting the system as the ambulatory chief medical officer. So that means I support quality in the outpatient space. I work across all of our departments and specialties to ensure that we're meeting our value-based contract metrics and delivering the patient experience that we expect every patient and family member to receive through Prisma Health.
So is your role limited to primary care physicians in the ambulatory space or all specialties as it relates to quality in the ambulatory environment?
While I spend a significant majority of my time supporting the primary medical specialties, I also touch the other departments and divisions within our system. As we know, we are all responsible for the total population that we deliver healthcare to here in the upstate.
Now, does Prisma have an accountable care organization?
Yes, we do. We have within Prisma Health two clinically integrated networks, one in the Midlands, as we refer to the Columbia market, and then our Prisma Health Upstate Network in Greenville and neighboring counties. Under the clinically integrated network, we have both employed physicians as well as self-employed. And we serve not only accountable care organizations with our MSSP, but other direct-to-employer contracts and Medicare Advantage plans.
What's the ratio between employed physicians versus independent physicians in the northern CIN, where you seem to have most of the responsibility?
Yes, it's approximately 2/3 employed.
Okay.
While a third self-employed for all providers.
Mm-hmm. And is that ratio true in the Midlands CIN as well?
It's a little different. There is a larger portion of self-employed practices or independent practices in that system.
So you have Medicare Advantage contracts, and you mentioned direct employer contracts. So you've already begun providing or contracting directly with large employers in your region?
Yes, we have. We have a Care Coordination Institute, or CCI, as we refer to it. And I like to think of it as our population health engine. And this is our resource of care management, data analytics, performance improvement specialist, rise up and support the entire provider network for a clinically integrated network across all of Prisma Health for both CINs.
So if you were to describe your job now compared to the chief medical officer role that you had when you first came to Greenville or when you were in Virginia at Danville, has the responsibility shifted from, say, the quality, safety, high reliability focus more into the population health, clinically integrated networking, ACO type of arena, or do you still have some of those foundational quality and high reliability responsibilities?
So it's an interesting question, Norm, and one that does appear to be somewhat of an evolution. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to start in the hospital space where high reliability and patient safety were coined as everyday terms in our hospitals. Once data for quality and safety was reportable through hospital compare, through leapfrog grading systems, we all began to pay more attention to the actual care that we delivered in a highly reliable way. And so with that experience, we transitioned from the hospital space to more focus, as you said yourself, the population health arena, which focuses primarily on outpatient care. Because after all, many of us see many of our hospitalizations as failures of a health system. Because the way we see it is our job and responsibility is to help support patients and their families to remain well and to manage chronic disease, to keep them out of the hospital, to reduce that cost of care so that if you're healthy on the front end, you have more quality of life and less disease and the less cost of care for a system, as we're completely responsible for that care now through our clinically integrated networks. So yes, it has been a transition of sorts from the inpatient back to the outpatient portion of the continuum of care. And for me, as a family physician by training, this is the best job in the world. I tell people all the time, as I'll repeat to you, this is the best job I've ever had. And for many reasons. One is because my heart as a family physician is in the outpatient space and prevention and mm-hmm. wellness. Mm-hmm. But then also the teams that I am privileged to work with every day makes an incredible difference. We know that, right? We know that teams are what create success in the work that we do.
The interesting thing, as you talk about this, many organizations are now experiencing the tension between the need to maintain volume and the fact that a large percentage of their revenue still comes from the old traditional fee-for-service model. And the new model, which is here to stay for sure, the value-based care, the population health, we have teams of physicians now, and you're part of that team that are really working to reduce the dependence of a population on what has been the bastion of our healthcare systems, the hospital. How does that tension manifest itself, or does it manifest itself within Prisma? How are they addressing that if it is an issue?
Well, Norm, it truly is a contradiction or paradox, if you will, of how we started healthcare as fee for service. And that was the incentive to provide more and more services and procedures. And as we've realized, that's not necessarily how we define wellness. And so while we still have a foot in two boats, that old cliche remains. And the adage is supported by the fact that fee-for-service is still a significant majority of the work that we do. However, it is time to begin to position our organization and our community to not only address their diseases and conditions, but also their social determinants of health, how we're assessing the whole picture. And so we have a few different ways that we do that. Of course, we still have our traditional services within our hospital and our focus on CLABSI and CLOTI and C. diff to prevent harm for patients from hospital-acquired conditions.
Right.
And then
right.
we also have our ambulatory team that connects through collaboration and making sure that, for example, advanced directives is an initiative we're looking at across the patient care continuum. That's very important to us. Whenever we consider immunizations, they occur both in the hospital and the outpatient space. And those are just a couple of areas where we're starting to see the difference. And then as we start to build capital, the question arises often, do we build more brick and mortar for institutes and resource centers, or do we start to invest in the community, in community centers that already exist, or combining some primary care space with perhaps our OBGYN partners? So it's been a tremendous amount of fun to watch the evolution occur, and working for a system that's progressive and innovative and piloting new ways to see what works, what doesn't work. It makes some folks nervous because it's not our traditional financial model. At the same time, what we've seen we've been able to deliver is through our value-based contracting and meeting those quality metrics and preventing disease or catching disease earlier than we used to.
You're involved in a tremendous amount of work and activity, obviously. You and I both know that in this day and age, we're seeing a tremendous rise in burnout amongst physicians, but also amongst all types of healthcare providers. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the struggle that we've touched on it before when you mentioned the struggles of beginning your family and maintaining some type of work-life balance. But I wonder if you could share your thoughts on whether you found it easier to control your work-life balance when you were in a fully clinical role, or now that you're in an administrative role. What do you think was more of the challenge, your current role or your previous roles when you had pretty much full-time clinical responsibility?
Well, Norm, that's a challenging question. And because I don't think I can say that one is less challenging or more challenging to balance as life cycles progress and as we internally determine ways to create that balance. I think it's possible to have balance in both types of careers, but it starts with setting boundaries and understanding what you're capable of, because everyone has a different work capacity. When I say that I don't mean laziness. What I mean is that, as you're aware, someone may be able to see 20 patients a day, another may be able to see 40. It's not that one is better or worse, but it's different. And each individual physician or provider really needs to find that sweet spot for themselves. And while some people prefer to get all the work done from 8 to 5, others believe that the best process or practice for them is to not use the computer in the room and then do all their work at night. Now, it really depends on what creates your own personal happiness. So what I have discovered over time is that if I can have dinner with my family most nights, and if I can put my 2 kids to bed every night, then that's happiness for me. I can work around that. I try to manage my schedule and my calendar. I've also recognized that if I have back-to-back meetings without any time in between, then it's difficult to catch your breath, if you will, from the morning till afternoon. So having that level of self-awareness is really important. And by being an executive, what that has allowed me to do is, if my child has a school program in the middle of the day, I can make those adjustments. Whereas when you're full-time clinical, you can't exactly disappear at 2 o'clock for 30 minutes or for 2 hours, because patient care just doesn't flow that way. So there are ups and drawbacks sometimes with being an executive. But at the same time, it has been the best move for me, and one that I have never looked back and enjoy doing and appreciate the balance that I currently have between clinical and administrative.
How does your organization support the need to have that type of flexibility for both its clinical physicians, advanced practice professionals, as well as administrative staff, whether they're physician executives or not?
Well, as a health system, we haven't always been historically extremely flexible, though we have learned with our providers and healthcare teams that by thinking outside the box and appreciating and flexing with our providers as much as feasible, we've created happier teams. And that's very important. So the days of requiring everyone to work a full 1.0 FTE or a full-time job is no longer an essential situation. If someone wants to work part-time, then we may find a partner to balance out their time. If someone would like to work 3/4 time, then we try to find a way to provide that access for patient care. I believe it's helped with the level of burnout because it's provided more autonomy for our providers. We have some schedules where people work 8 to 5. We have others where they may work 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And we really give them that opportunity to decide, do they want to work 3 days a week? Do they want to work 5 days a week? We also build in a half day of admin time to catch up on medical records or paperwork or anything that needs to be handled within the office to give them that breathing room. And so those are some changes that we've seen over time.
Yeah, I think those are good strategies. And I think we're seeing a lot more organizations of pay attention to these things because this epidemic that we're facing of provider or physician burnout or staff burnout is just becoming a problem that's undeniable at this point in healthcare.
Yeah, I agree.
So besides dinner with your family, making sure you're there to tuck your kids into bed at night, what other things do you enjoy doing outside of your professional life? What other hobbies do you have that help keep you grounded or centered or recharge your batteries?
A couple of them revolve around also keeping myself healthy and making sure that I practice good self-care. So making sure I get 7 hours of sleep a night is a goal that I shoot for. I don't always get there, but I do almost read every single evening. For me, I enjoy that time to decompress and just to take a moment to read something that doesn't have to do with work. It's not one of my journals, just to relax. And I try to do that again every night. I also enjoy playing tennis. And so you've heard me talk about my children, not as much about my husband. And what we have intentionally done over the years as our children have grown is maintain the activities that we enjoy doing together. So you can typically find us on Saturdays out on the tennis court. Or today, I was sharing with you, I took a day off and we went cycling down to another community, had lunch and came back. So I try to fit in time with my family, as a whole, and also my husband. So playing tennis or hiking or reading or traveling, those are some of the things that I enjoy doing to help provide that balance. And one other thing I'll mention, Norm, is as physicians, we often feel as if the practice can't do without us, or even as administrators, well, we're going to miss that very important meeting. And what I've discovered is even if you take your time off, your vacation, the world goes on without you.
Right, right.
So we have a choice. We can take the vacation or we can skip vacation. And I choose to maintain that balance with time off.
I think that is so important. So one of the questions I was going to ask you, and I know today you said you had the chance to go out on the bike ride, but it sounds like you and your husband managed to carve out a little bit of extra time today during your ride, correct?
Yes, we did. Are you referring to the blowout on the bike?
That's right.
Well, and you know, that's something that I'm not always good at, Norm, because I plan every minute of my life. And we had just enough time to bike ride before our call this evening. And whenever we had a blowout, my first thought was, well, how am I going to adjust the schedule today? So, but we got the tire fixed. We got back on the road. And I appreciate you flexing up for an hour too. So
no, that's fine. Those are the types of things that actually make the memories even more special in my experience, are those unplanned events that you just have to adjust to. They keep us humble as well.
They do. You know, we're at the end of the day, we're all human.
That's right. So I wonder if to sort of wrap up the interview, I know many of my listeners are physicians, obviously, who are struggling with or considering what to do with their career. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the one or two people that had the greatest impact on your career and on the decisions that you made.
Well, two come to mind. And one, what list of those who inspire us would be complete if we did not include our mothers in many cases. So my mother would be top of the list, someone who's always believed in me. In the days that I was just too tired and wanted to throw in the towel, she would remind me of why I started this journey in the first place and would keep me going. She keeps me honest. She keeps me human and grounded. And I so very much appreciate her for that. But from a business perspective or healthcare as an industry, one of my early mentors since medical school is Dr. Ed Shahady. Now, Dr. Ed Shahady is in his 70s at this point, in fact, approaching 80. And he continues to be one of the wisest mentors in my life and through my experiences and throughout the years has provided me guidance in so many different ways. I always come up with an Ed Shahady phrase or quote that he would use. And mm-hmm. one of them that really stands out to me, especially from a leadership perspective, I remember this when I was in residency and struggling sometimes with when do you speak up and say what you believe and when do you stay quiet because you don't want to stir the waters. And I remember him saying, Saria, you can either be popular or you can lead. And so you choose. If you want to be popular, by all means, you don't necessarily join the committee, and absolutely you never lead it because you will never make everyone happy. But you've got to do what you think is right. And that's leadership. And leadership requires courage. And I think that's really important to consider. Another good quote he gave me was, Saria, just don't do anything that you don't want your patients to read about tomorrow morning in the newspaper.
That's a good one.
It is. And yes. It has stuck with me now that, you know, many of us don't get the paper on our front lawn anymore, but online media and social media is present in our lives constantly. And it's been good advice. And it also helps keep me above the line as a leader. And at night before I go to bed, that's something I ask myself. Can I go to sleep tonight feeling that I've done what I think is the right thing, that I have spoken up for those who are vulnerable, that I've been fair and I've been consistent? And Dr. Ed Shahady is one of the good reasons for that. He has reinvented himself in several different ways as a family physician and a speaker and in many different ways. And for that, I also admire him as a mentor because we continue to change. And as I look at my career and starting off in solo practice, and I thought I would do that for the rest of my life. Never thought I would then go on to be a teacher and administrator and have the privilege to do what I do today. But I do think it's important as physicians and as clinicians that we are open to change, that we support others who are interested in change, that we raise each other up and recognize those who work hard and who are performing well, and identifying what they do for patients and sharing those stories with others.
You know, I'm struck by those. Both of those quotes are fantastic quotes. And to me, it just reinforces how important integrity on the one hand is to our careers. And secondly, how important courage is as we try to take care of patients or as we try to lead other physicians or as we try, as you're doing now, to improve healthcare for communities on a wholesale level. But what really is more important than our integrity and the courage to change things for the better in our communities?
And that's right. And Norm, that's all we control in life is our own integrity and our own courage.
Yes. So here's my last question for you. And I, Saria, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate you being on the show. But I would wonder if you could share for just a moment a couple of pieces of advice for physicians. Let's say you're talking to a physician who was where you were in 2008. You've always thought you would continue to practice clinical medicine, and your life situation is changing. What advice do you have for people when they are faced with this choice of, do I continue down this path, or an opportunity is opening up in front of me over here? Do I go down that path?
And it's such a personal path or journey that we experience. And when individuals have asked me this question in the past, I just have them reflect back on what is important to them. Where is their heart leading them? Where are their minds leading their work? And we need to be open. We need to be open for what's in front of us. And if someone recognizes leadership in you, then step forward, have courage, and maintain your integrity. It can be challenging at times, as we know that in medicine. Sometimes we can get worn down, but it's important to be courageous and do the right thing, to be fair, to be consistent, and always learn. Being an avid reader, reading everything you can get your hands on, maintaining your clinical specialty, I think is very important. And something that I don't believe I received a tremendous amount of training on was truly being a team player. I recall on many occasions in medical school and residency where we talk about the physician as the captain of the ship. And sometimes that's true. But what we also have to recognize is that everyone we come into contact with in healthcare is an expert. The patient is an expert in themselves. Nurses are an expert in care at the bedside. And they're also excellent teachers. Administrators can be experts in finances and planning and strategy. And one of the best lessons I learned in my first role as a CMO was that the team will help you look good. Rely on your team. They work well together. If you can create a team that celebrates the success of everyone, that goes a long way. And as physicians, again, we're told that, well, if you don't know the answer, then maybe you're not a good doctor. You know, that's perhaps not directly the message we've received, but I think it has also encouraged us to be the first one to speak up, the one that feels like we have to have the plan, but loosen up a little bit and listen to others. I think that's very important. I quickly realized, as I mentioned, my first job in Danville, a couple of weeks into the job, I remember going home to my husband going, oh, wow, there is so much to learn. And while I may be an expert in family medicine and delivering that care at the bedside, there's a whole system, an ecosystem of team players and people who participate in healthcare that we can learn a tremendous amount from. So again, being open and courageous to do where your heart or your mind is taking you, and remembering that you're not always the expert, and that's okay. It's also a factor of relief.
I love what you said about being open. As I listen to the story of how your career developed, and it will be interesting to stay in touch with you over the next several years and into the future to find out what new opportunities you decide to take advantage of. But your path sounds very similar to mine in that if I hadn't been open to opportunities, I would never have experienced many of the highs in my career that I have. And I probably would not have been as involved with some of the administrative responsibilities as I am today. It strikes me that many of us start out from medical school with a certain vision for our lives and our careers. And when we look back over 10 or 20 or 30 years, or even longer in some cases, not mentioning any names, but as we look back at our careers, we just find that we had really never anticipated where our work would take us or our passions would take us and how fulfilling our careers would be in ways that we didn't really even consider.
I absolutely agree with that, Norm. And I think it's very important as physicians that we remember and embrace the privilege that we've had, the privilege to go to medical school in the first place. Just recently, I uncovered my letter into medical school. And on that letter welcoming me to the class of 2001 at University of Florida, Dr. Robert Hatch signed it. And he wrote on there, "Saria, you have an interesting story, and I can't wait for you to share your interesting perspective in medical school." And Norm, I didn't come from a family of doctors. I grew up in a trailer with multiple children in and out of the home. I wasn't one to go to medical school. So I promised that day that I would make my position and my role in medical school worth it, and to prove to them they didn't make the wrong decision. And just last week, I wrote a letter to Dr. Hatch to recognize him and congratulate him for a lifetime achievement as an educator for Society of Teachers of Family Medicine. And I printed a copy of that letter for him to see, because what we don't always recall is how it felt to have that initial privilege and the people who have touched our lives over the years. And that's really important, that we have a positive and an equally potential for a negative interaction and response with others. So being mindful of that, and whether we know we're being watched, you're always being watched. All physicians are being watched as role models. And that's really important to remember and embrace and appreciate that we've had this opportunity.
Well, that's tremendous. And Saria, I can't thank you enough. I knew this was going to be a great episode, and it hasn't disappointed me. I've really appreciated your openness and the communication and the sharing of your story with my listeners. I hope that we can have another conversation on my podcast at some point in the future.
I look forward to it. This has been so much fun. Thank you, Norm, for the invite.
Well, that wraps up our show for today. Thank you, Sarah, for taking the time to join me on the show. I would like you all to please subscribe to the podcast. so you don't miss any of the episodes of Physicians Beyond the Bedside. I have the top 10 leadership skills and attributes for physician leaders available on my website at physiciansbeyondthebedside.com. Leave your name and your email on the website, and I will be happy to send you a copy. Included in the show notes for today's show will be a link to the list of the top 10 leadership skills, along with other valuable links from today's show. If you have any comments or questions, I would really appreciate it if you would add them in the comment section on the website, physiciansbeyondthebedside.com. I really love hearing from all of you, from any of you, and I'm happy to answer any and all questions. Please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking on the subscribe button that will be in the show notes also. In the next episode of Physicians Beyond the Bedside, I will be discussing the secrets of the hidden job market and how you can find the perfect role for you using this tool. Don't miss the episode. Good luck moving beyond the bedside. I have a special offer for you today. I have created a list of the top 10 skills physicians need to be maximally effective in leadership roles. The skills I included on the list have been studied and found to increase the effectiveness of leaders in all organizations. You need to cultivate these skills when you assume a leadership role. Physicians are leaders not only in clinical settings, but in non-clinical settings as well. These skills will benefit you, whether you are at the bedside or beyond. Please visit my website at beyondthebedside.net/top10leadership skills for your free copy of this excellent resource today. I will also place a link to this resource in the show notes. Feel free to click on that in the show notes below.